Welcome to All About Business with me, James Reed, the podcast that covers everything about business, management, and leadership. Every episode, I sit down with different guests who have bootstrapped companies, masterminded investment models, or built a business empire. They're leaders in their field, and they're here to give you top insights and actionable advice so that you can apply their ideas to your own career or business venture.
What does it mean to build a business you don't want to sell? And how do you grow while staying true to your values? Today on All About Business, I'm joined by Victoria Stapleton, founder of Brora, a British fashion and lifestyle brand that has grown from Scottish cashmere into a multi-category business rooted in craftsmanship and long-term thinking. In this episode, we discuss how retail has changed, why slower growth can be a strength, and what happens when you choose legacy over exit? Well, today on All About Business, I'm really delighted to welcome Victoria Stapleton to the studio. Victoria is the creative director and founder of Brora, which is a wonderful British fashion brand specializing in luxury cashmere and beautiful clothing. Brora is known for combining traditional British craftsmanship with bold colors, patterns, and contemporary designs. And I know, Victoria, that you're a strong advocate for ethical production, sustainability, and I'm pleased to say British manufacturing. So thanks so much for coming in to talk to me today. I am, in fact, wearing Brora.
Thank you.
I'm a long-standing customer of yours, an admirer of your brand and your work. I'd love to begin at the beginning, really, with the origin story, because you started the company in 1993, I believe.
Yeah, it was sort of an accident. A happy accident, as it turns out. But I was made redundant. So I have also had that experience. I know what it's
from
like
where?
To be made
what,
redundant.
Doing what?
I was working for a tweed mill in Scotland called Hunters of Brora.
Right.
Hunters of Brora had been going since 1901. It went into receivership in 1990. And my father, amongst other people, decided to save it from going down the pan. It was in the village of Brora, which is right up in the northeast of Scotland. And he asked me to come along. I'd been working for an interior designer in London. I was probably 22. And he said, can you come and revamp the shop in the village? Let's make it into the Harrods of the North, you know, this little shop in the Station Square in Brora, and fill it with lovely things. Use the tweed from the mill, but also find other Scottish produce. You know, here's a really great guy I've met along the way who runs one of the best cashmere mills. You know, fill it with lovely things and we'll do a mail order business. And I was like, oh, I really work for Dad. You know, this is
right.
Very strong personality. But it was also really exciting and tempting as, you know, a creative journey and something to do my next bit of my career. And basically, the retail got so much bigger so quickly and they needed the cash flow to keep the mill going, to keep the tweed being on those machines.
Right.
And the mill was employing 100 people in the village of Brora.
Right.
And that was the essence of why they saved the mill in the beginning, was to keep that intact. And as you'll know, with retail, you need a lot of money for stock. And so they decided to close down the retail operation, which I was head of.
Right. And that's why you were made redundant.
And that's why I was made redundant.
But you obviously retained a love for Brora.
Yeah. So I just turned around and went, God, do I start? Do I go and try and work for somebody else doing something totally different? Or actually, I've really fallen in love with all these Scottish textiles. I think there's something really exciting here. And if I can take this concept to London and make it a bit more groovy, because we were doing quite a lot of country kit, and I'd have my own, you know, control and DNA. And I just had met all these amazing suppliers. I suppose it had been 2 years. And I thought, okay, I think I can do this. And I went to the mill and said, do you mind if I called the business Brora after the village? And I really had no idea how good a name that would be, because it's sort of one of those names that people go, Brora, what's that? Where's that?
Yes.
It's something they repeat once or twice. And actually the two R's either side of the O, and the O is now a thistle and it's sort of symmetrical.
Yes, great.
So that's the beginnings.
So you mentioned that you sort of brought this thought to London. So you were relying on your supplier from the mill.
So
what did you begin with? What did you make first?
I think the cashmere was the key thing. That's where I saw the market. That's where I saw there was, you know, a possibility, because I did a bit of research and everything in London that was cashmere was behind glass doors in a very small shop in somewhere like the Burlington Arcade. And a lovely lady of some age, you'd come in and she'd say, it was like getting the crown jewels out of the glass doors and putting it on the counter. And you couldn't open it up or try it on. It was like, would you like this very precious piece? And to be honest, they were pretty much the same price as they are now.
Right.
You know, you paid several hundred pounds for a sort of Burlington Arcade navy blue round neck jumper. And they were very much navy, black, cream, camel, maybe a bit of red.
Right.
But there was nothing in green, burnt orange, turquoise, fuchsia, primrose yellow, ochre, you know, all the colours that Brora is so synonymous with.
So what was the first thing you sold then?
Very early on, I did this little thing called a cashmere cropped cardigan, which was tiny wee. And it's still in the collection today.
So that was aimed at women?
It was aimed at women, yeah. Not kids. No, it was just, it was a very sassy, the original one was from the 1950s. So it was a very high-waisted, tight-waisted little cardi, high neck, neat fitting with 3/4 length sleeves. And the original one was a vintage one. And I also used to raid my mum's wardrobe because we were brought up in Cumbria. So we were very near actually all the mills in the Scottish borders. So quite often we'd go and have a rummage in the mill shop. So I sort of knew about cashmere from an early age, not from a spoiled point of view, just because I lived very close to where it was all happening. And so mum had some great vintage cashmere pieces in her wardrobe. So I'd take some of those up to the mill and the guy who ran the mill would be like, oh my God, I remember making this, you know, 20 years ago, or it was an original 70s piece or whatever. And this was 1993. So we slowly basically started with the cashmere. And I can't tell you, James, it was the easiest business. I pretty much had one supplier.
Right.
Now I've got about 100.
Yeah.
And you're firefighting with production all the time. But this was a beautiful relationship.
One supplier that working very well for you and more customers by the sound of things.
Yeah, and somebody very supportive, actually. He was a bit of a mentor and he's sadly not with us. He died very suddenly of a heart attack about age 75, I think about eight, maybe 10 years ago now. And he was, you know, godfather to one of my children. And he was a guy called James Sugden, and he got an OBE for his, for what he did for textiles in Scotland.
So he helped you advised you a bit.
Unbelievable, yeah.
So that's interesting. So it was good to have a mentor and you...
Yeah, it was really good to have a mentor on not so much the financial side and the business side, because I was quite savvy on that. Dad had been brilliant on that. So I'd been brought up with gross margin and profit and loss and how you ran a business.
So what
really.
Business was he running, your dad?
He did lots of different things, but his big one that I remember, because it was during my teenage years, was he started something called Pinneys of Scotland, which was a smoked salmon business. And because, again, we were on the border of Cumbria and Scotland, it was in Scotland. It needed to have the Scottish address.
Right.
And I understood that thing of the authenticity and something coming from Scotland and Scottish smoked salmon. So it was like Scottish cashmere was a sort of natural lead on from that.
Scotland has a very strong brand, actually.
Yeah, very strong. Around the world. I mean, everyone wants to go to Scotland more than they want to go to England.
Yeah, well, they've been clever at marketing it. I mean, they've been...
Yeah.
And your brand is consistent with that.
Yeah. No, it's key that we have. We have two shops in Edinburgh, one in the airport and one in the city centre. Yes. And that's people want to come to Scotland and take something home that's made in Scotland.
So you started this business before the internet, which is interesting to me. So, you know, sort of establishing a brand and building a customer base before the internet. How did you do that?
Yeah, I think it was maybe easier in some way. The press really mattered then.
Right.
If you got something in the paper, your phone rang off the hook. And I had the most exceptional moment. You know, you remember in a business your lucky moments, those turning points. And basically, it went from being Hunters of Brora to Brora on the 1st of March, 1993. And I got and it was going to be in my home in London, in a room. I mean, nothing grand at all. Cardboard boxes all around me. And I got a phone call from somebody who was assisting Lucia van der Post at the time. And she was writing an article on the best cashmere around. And she had met Dad over the years, knew about Hunters of Brora. And I said, well, actually, Lucia, we you know, just made a change and it's now going to be called Brora and all the cashmere is the same. It's from the best mill in Scotland. And she wrote an article that Saturday. Literally, I'd launched the business on the 1st of March and it was something like the 2nd of March. Mm. And it said, this is where you buy your cashmere. And a black cashmere jumper costs £99. And this is the phone number. Really? And it was my home phone number. And literally, my flatmates were going mad.
That was ringing off the hook, was it?
Not something. It was just
me. Where did
me.
This article appear? This
it was in the FT.
Oh, fantastic.
It was in the Financial Times.
With their how to spend it section or whatever. Yeah,
and I literally took orders. This is 1993. I took orders for £10,000 worth of cashmere jumpers just from that little paragraph.
Right.
And they all just said, can I have the black cashmere jumper that Lucia van der Voorst talks about?
Right.
Well, it's just like, literally my children would be amazed by that because it just, that does not happen today.
No.
Now, to do that sort of business, you need Claudia Winkleman to wear it on The Traitors.
Right.
And she has.
I thought you might say that. I thought that might have been coming next. So Claudia Winkleman wears it on The Traitors.
Yeah,
well, there
I
you
mean,
go. That's the modern equivalent.
She's at a Scottish castle.
Exactly. What could be? What else could she possibly wear? I mean, completely see this. The
no,
sort of,
but it's the influencer now. It's the sort of, you know, it's digital. You know, it's who's wearing your kit is the most influential bit.
Yes. And making people aware of that, I guess.
Yeah.
So your brand grew. When did you open a shop? When did you move out of your sort of home?
Yeah, I was really nervous about opening a shop. So basically, once these aforesaid flatmates got fed up at the phone and the cardboard boxes and stumbling into, you know, things as they came through, drunk through the door, I said, okay, I think I better get a studio. So I then got a studio, which was sort of by appointment, but I did all my mail order there. It was still sort of over the phone. Hello, you know, Mrs. Smith, yes, I can send you this today. And I got the first shop in 1996, so 3 years later. But for those first 3 years, what's really one to remember is every day at 5 o'clock, I got in my car and I drove to the post office with all my parcels that I had packaged up myself. And if you were behind me in the queue in the post office, you really knew it was a bad day.
Right.
Because I was there for hours weighing each one, putting the stamps on. And, you know, so just doing all that stuff yourself.
So you did everything?
I did everything until I'd been going for 6 months. And then I employed one person. And she was with me for the next 15 years.
Did you know that there are nearly 1 million 18 to 24-year-olds who are currently not in education, employment or training in the UK? This is simply not good enough. And I want to do something about it. That's why Reed is launching a new initiative, giving £20,000 to young entrepreneurs to help them grow their small business. Visit reed.com/entrepreneurs to find out more. We want to support and encourage the next generation of entrepreneurs. But it's really, I think that sort of doing everything is very valuable, isn't it? In terms of understanding your own business and especially understanding your customers. I mean, you obviously were talking to the customers.
You speak to everyone, to all of them, and some of them become real friends, you know. And actually, it was one of the things I was talking about the other day, you know, on the phones now, we don't get nearly so many phone calls because 90% of people are going to, if they're ordering to get it sent to their home, they're ordering online.
Yes.
But 10% of people ring and they really want to talk about what the weather's like in Cornwall and what their grandson would like for his birthday or, you know.
You have people to talk to them.
Yeah, we do. We have six ladies. Yeah. Again, most of them have been with us.
Where are they? Where?
They're in our lovely head office in Stevenage.
Right.
So I live in Hertfordshire, so we opened our head office. We bought an amazing big warehouse.
Right.
In Stevenage. I like to see all the goods going in and out. I don't want a distribution centre. I like to know it's all in one building. You know at a glance what your stock situation. You can look at your stock on a bit of paper, but there's nothing like walking around the warehouse to know what you're short
on. So your office is in the warehouse?
Yeah, so the office is upstairs.
Yeah.
We've got a photographic studio, we've got a design studio, we've got finance, we've got marketing, we've got the web team, we've got
all together in Stevenage.
Yeah, all together. Pattern cutting rooms, you know, amazing, amazing space that we bought about maybe 15, 18 years ago.
Right. So you walk around the warehouse.
Yeah, love it. Love it.
So when did you last walk around and how was it?
Yesterday, I see Ian comes in the earliest. He comes in, I don't know, about 6:30. He loves an early start.
Right.
And and he'll probably clock off at 2:30. People do different hours. They do. We're very like flexible.
Yeah, but that's
as long as they do their day, they come within reason.
Yeah, if you're in distribution, it's good to start early before the traffic.
Yeah, exactly.
So do you think something's been lost in the way we do business today with so much of it going online and so much of it being sort of impersonal in a sense?
Yeah, but I think it's amazing for the consumer that they can, and online's become so good. So if you look at Arlo online, there's going to be at least six images of the thing you're going to buy. You've got front, back, you've got video, you know, you've got information, all the colours, you've got customer reviews. So you know exactly, you can look down at the bottom, see seven people have bought it, if they've needed to size up, size down. So you've got so much information at your fingertips. And I think that's, you know, amazing for the customer.
Your business is a blend of shops and online now.
We love that. Yeah. I love that. I love a shop. I mean, I love walking. I would say invariably, what you think you're going to choose by looking online will end up being totally different if you come to the store. Really? You might like that, but you might try it on and go, it's not quite what I wanted, but actually I love the look of this dress or I love that jumper. And so I just think that nothing beats coming and seeing, feeling, trying on. Also, I'm rather proud that our products all feel so good.
Right.
So, you know, a brand might photograph something and it looks great in the picture and you get it and it's as stiff as a board and the fabric's not nice and they haven't lined it properly. Like, we have lots of secrets in our clothes. Like, quite often we put lace trim on the bottom of a lining of a dress. So it's lined and then you've, like a proper petticoat. But we don't show that online. We can't show that online. So that's like a little surprise. Or we hand sew these tiny copper beads on the hems of our dresses and it weighs them down and gives them a swish. But you can't really see that online. So people discover things. I think the clothes should look as good on the inside as they do on the outside.
Sure. So the shops are very important for that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And relationships.
And from what you're just saying, obviously the brand has moved from jumpers to a whole clothing range.
Yeah, which is really exciting.
Yeah.
I mean,
when did that occur?
It happened quite a bit. I mean, that's a funny old story because obviously, as I said, it was very simple running a business with one fabulous supplier, a guy who I got on with so well. And we made from wrist warmers to snoods to hats to jumpers, men, women, you know, started doing children's things when I had my first baby, who's 28 now. But we had to put something with the jumpers and the brochure. The models had to wear something. They couldn't just be in their knickers, or we couldn't have every shot cropped off.
No, that's a very good point.
Yeah. So it's like, what are they going to wear? Well, they couldn't really wear other people's brands because otherwise that would seem
Who are you selling?
Oh, exactly. Yeah. So I used to go to vintage markets and I'd go to Portobello and vintage markets and flea markets. And I'd buy maybe one season, I'd buy great big tutus or I'd just buy beautiful lace skirts and dresses. And I'd put all these vintage pieces with the cashmere. And then people started saying, oh, I'd really like to buy the dress in the picture. I'd like to buy the skirt. I want to buy everything she's wearing. So I was like, oh, maybe I've got a bit of an eye for this.
Well, good for you. So that's how you sort of develop your range.
So yeah, then I knew nothing. I mean, that's complicated, James. The jumpers is easy. That is complicated. Cutting, patterns, the right fabric for the right design, the lining. There's so many components in a bit of clothing. So knitwear is, you know, it goes on the machine. It's, you know, the specs done and it's the yarn. But, and of course, sometimes on cardigans, you have grosgrain ribbon and buttons and things. But a knitwear is, it's just a much simpler thing.
So how did you learn this whole new trade?
Trial and error and quite a lot of errors.
Right.
I did get an amazing production manager in the end, who had had his own cut, make and trim factory on the outskirts of London. He's still with me today. He's called Gary.
Right.
And his factory made for Jean Muir, who was an amazing designer. And he was making all her stuff in the 80s and 90s. And then when Jean Muir went under, his business went under because I think they owed him 30 grand or something. So I just saw his CV came onto my desk at exactly the right time. And I rang this guy and he lived in Hertfordshire. And we were still in London at the time. And I said, Gary, I promise you the business is going to move to Hertfordshire, but can you come to start commuting into London for the first 5 years? And he's been a godsend because he understood it right from the beginning. So he has found his factories. You know, he works with the pattern cutters. He works with the production.
So good recruitment there.
Very
good. A good plug for recruitment.
Yeah.
Yeah, recruiting someone who knows.
Yeah, it was really brilliant. It was a lucky...
I think a really good hire like that makes a huge difference, and you're just sort of illustrating.
Yeah, and I think actually that's maybe been... It's really funny because I'm quite slapdash actually, but I'm quite good on people, I suppose. I take quite a gut feeling about somebody in an interview process. I'm not that interested in their CV because they wouldn't be there if their CV hadn't got them there. You know, yes. They've got the skills. I know that. So I sort of need to know if they're going to be a good fit with me and with the team.
Yes.
And they've got some integrity, some loyalty. And
over the years, you've built a strong team, it sounds
I've
like.
Got amazing. I mean, my head of buying, who is really exceptional, she's been with me nearly 25 years.
Right.
My finance director's been with me over 20 years. My MD at the moment's just on 10 years, and I had somebody before him who did about 15 years. So, yeah, it's been... I've got some really fabulous people who know the business very well.
That's so important, I think. So you decided to grow this business organically.
Yeah, you know, I didn't really know any other way. But yeah.
So was that a conscious choice, or was it just sort of... just happened?
I think
it's
much
a strategy
less
I subscribe
scary.
To, but yeah. what was
your thinking?
Yeah, I think
it's much less scary, isn't it? If you're not very greedy, if money's not the key thing, if it's not your key performance indicator, whatever you'd say, then it's a very nice way to grow organically because you sort of can keep up with the customer demand. The quality doesn't let you down. You sort of know everybody who comes into the business who's working for you. You can grow their strengths and train them up properly because you've sort of got that time. There just seem to be so many benefits. The other huge thing is you don't need to borrow money from anyone. So we never had to borrow from the bank. We never had to get outside investors. And hence why I've always been the 100% owner of the business until recently. And we can talk about that later. But... it means that you have 100% control of your business and you're not answerable to anybody. Nobody's ringing you up every 3 months and saying, how are the accounts? What's it looking like? And we all know with business, you have ups and downs. You have bad times, you have good times.
It's certainly true. That's certainly true. So retaining your control and not putting the business in jeopardy was an important part of your thinking, it sounds to me.
Yeah, I think I just, as much as anything, Brora is quite a lifestyle business. You know, I really wanted to spend time with my children as well, with my family. They probably say I am a workaholic, but actually I like a good game of tennis or anything else in the middle of the day as well. So, you know, I wasn't going to be one of those people who didn't have a life outside work. I had really wanted the balance.
Yes.
And I think growing a business organically means that you sort of are more likely to get that.
So that's worked well for you. I mean, you've been in business now for more than 30 years.
Yeah.
So how do you balance sort of staying timeless? You talk about clothing for decades rather than seasons, with the need to keep up with trends and being sort of relevant.
Funny, James, isn't it? It's sort of so much of what you do is innate. So much of it, what you do is in your sort of DNA. So I think it's very difficult to do things when they don't come naturally to you. So I suppose where I started Brora with the Scottish cashmere. I mean, the sort of people who make at the mill alongside me are Chanel and Hermes and Louis Vuitton, Burberry. You know, it's very high-end Parisian couture brands and Brora. So by its very nature, our cashmere is incredibly high quality, which does mean, unless the old moth get hold of it, it lasts for years and years and years. Mm. And especially if it's well looked after. And a lot of people buying cashmere do actually wash it and put it in zip bags and they care for it because it's expensive.
Mm.
So I suppose that in turn meant that it needs to be fairly classic what you're doing. Otherwise, people are going to look at it in 5 years' time and go, well, I don't really feel like wearing that zany, stripy jumper now. But over the years, we've done some amazing statement pieces as well. Mm. And I suppose that nowadays, because the cashmere has become more and more expensive for all the obvious reasons, the clothing's where we might make more of a flash thing or more of a seasonal thing. But I still see people who keep their clothes and then they go back to it like 10 years later. They look in their wardrobe and go, God, or it gets passed down to their children. Mm. I mean, there's a massive raid on mothers' wardrobes of Brora. As you probably know in your family.
That's the ultimate compliment, isn't it? The next generation want to wear it.
Honestly.
That's a good sign.
Honestly, I have to put pictures of me wearing something, you know, that I suddenly think, where has that gone? I put it on the family WhatsApp group and say, I've got five daughters.
five daughters. Yeah.
The raid's big.
Well, they're probably quite good as a sort of... customer sort of input for you as well.
Honestly, design input. Yeah. They're so stylish in all in different ways. And they're 23 is the youngest and 37 is the eldest.
So
the first two are my stepdaughters and then I've got three daughters with Johnny together. But, you know, they all dress in a different way and I really notice what they wear.
So using the next generation sounding board is a good thing. So you've mentioned... The importance of your suppliers, and you mentioned that you had one right at the beginning, but now you said over 100. What do you think about in terms of relying on suppliers? What do you look for in suppliers? You obviously use traditional craftspeople. This is a very important part of your sort of business ethos. How do you make sure that sort of works for everybody?
I mean, when I say over 100, I mean, it's not an exaggeration because you might get buttons from somewhere and lining from somewhere, but they're not what I call sort of key suppliers.
Right.
We probably have, 15 really key suppliers. So we do try and give quite a lot of work to one manufacturer because it really builds a sense of loyalty and partnership. And I think that's quite key. It's sort of like, if you want to trade in season, which I have learned is pretty key to your bottom line, if you see something that's, you don't know, we do not know, there's no crystal ball that tells you that is the dress that's going to fly. You can make a bit of an assumption based on past seasons, based on history, based on the data, but it's very difficult to make a judgment as to what piece is going to be the one that season.
Right.
So if you can remake within season, if you can see that trend very early on and say, okay, we're going to take a punt and we're going to order another 300 of those or whatever it is, then that can be very crucial to your figures for that season.
Right.
So working closely with good partners where you are quite a big part of their business means that they're more likely to turn things around quickly for you when they need to.
So you're an important customer for them.
Yeah.
And they
not everywhere.
No.
And I notice the difference.
Right.
Between somewhere where we only make a few things and where slightly bottom of the pile, our production might get delayed a bit. They're very good at what they do. We don't do a lot of suede and leather. So if we do one jacket with somebody, we might be the person who, if they've got to delay one thing because things are not going quite right, it might be us. Whereas another supplier, we're 50% of what they're producing in their whole factory. So we are like top dollar.
What I'm hearing, I think, is that in your customers, demand is unclear. You don't know it from season to season what are going to be the real star products. So you need a supplier who can respond quickly and make you more of something, which favours the British over Chinese.
I mean, is that right?
It sort of depends on the supplier,
but it is amazing. The mill in Scotland, what is so incredible about them. I mean, last winter when we were on the traitors a lot and our cashmere wrist warmers, these fingerless gloves we do, that again, we've done since day one, these fingerless gloves. Claudia wears them in almost every scene on the traitors. So suddenly we needed, another 300 in black. Yeah. And the mill could turn that around in a week.
Yeah.
You
really need that, don't you? You can't wait a month or 2 months because people lose interest.
No, interestingly, there's a limit. Mm. I know the limit. If something's really good and it's quite near the beginning of the season, people will wait 6 weeks.
Right.
They will pre-order, know they're getting it in 6 weeks. And there's also something quite sexy about pre-order. It means, God, I'm getting hold of something that is a bit like gold dust. So they, and there's only a limited, we will always keep it to a limited amount. Like we've never made 1,000 or something.
Right.
Like that just doesn't happen abroad. So I don't really want it to happen. I don't want everyone wearing, remember there was that story with Zara once, like it was a long time ago and everyone was wearing this same jacket, everyone this coat, and it got sort of became the thing. You know, and obviously they're different and they're making 100,000s of units, but you know, we generally make, you know, 150, 200 of a dress, of a skirt. Right. And then if it goes really well, we can make some more, but that's sort of, you know, where we're at.
Yeah, so that enables you to sort of stay very close to customers and move quickly.
Yeah.
Retail seems to have changed quite a lot. I mean, you mentioned that you love the shops. Do you spend much time in the shops yourself? Is it?
Well, after this, I'll definitely go down to Marylebone High Street. I love looking after a customer, especially somebody who's lost their way a bit.
Right.
And either they've lost some weight or they've put on some weight or they've, let's say they've moved from London to the country or they moved from the country to London. I don't know. Somebody who's just a little bit lost. You know, they've had children and they don't want to dress in the same way as they did before. There's just sort of nothing quite like finding the right thing for somebody and then going out of the shop with a real smile on their face.
So you'll help people choose. And
yeah, I love doing that. And also it's really good getting people into maybe a colour that they didn't think was right for them. And then they put it on and they go, God, wow, I look quite well in this. I look great.
So this is a really important role for your physical stores then, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. I think customer service, I mean, customer service is second to none, but I have noticed recently, James, in retail that everybody is upping their game in terms of their interior design.
Right.
It is a massive thing at the moment. You've only got to walk down Marylebone High Street where it's, you know, beautiful shop after beautiful shop. And these are not Gucci, Prada, Versace. This is upmarket high street stores.
Right.
And they are really spending serious money on their shop fits.
So what's changed here? Why is that happening? Competition.
I think people know if they want to get people into their stores and not just buying online, they've got to make them feel amazing. They've got to walk in. It's got to smell good. It's got to look good. They've got to be well looked after. They've got to be tempted. They've got to really feel it.
So it's a whole experience.
Yeah.
You need to compete with someone sitting at home.
And hence why, in the last 2 years, we are now on a program of refitting our entire shop portfolio. And we're halfway through.
That's a big investment.
So it's a big investment.
And how long would you expect a shop fit to last? How long would you depreciate that over?
Well, it takes 4 weeks to do the shop fit. So the shop's got to be closed for that 4 weeks. So you've got to choose a particular... your most challenging month of the year.
Right.
So we just did Edinburgh in February. Right. Probably didn't miss much trade.
Yeah.
Last August, we did both Sloane Square and Marylebone High Street, August, July, August, over a period of 8 weeks. And we would write that off over a four-year period.
Right.
And they're all actually, we won't do it unless we know we've got a 10-year lease on that store.
Right.
So we do it once we've signed our new 10-year lease. Then we say, okay, we're going to do this investment. We know we're going to be here for the next 10 years. And actually, it's the sort of, the shop fit is to such a high standard what we're doing. It'll easily last. You know, we might need a lick of paint, but it's there for the duration.
Yeah. So you've done something very interesting in the last couple of years. You've changed your ownership structure.
Yeah, I didn't think I'd ever do that.
you've gone from being the sole owner, shareholder, haven't you? Is this right? To becoming an employee-owned, majority-owned business.
It's an employee ownership trust. It's an EOT, which some people might have read about. It's slightly unknown. And shall I tell you the reason it
Please explain what it is and then why you did it. Yeah, because I think this is really interesting. You're the first guest I've had on the podcast who's undertaken this journey, so I'd like to understand.
So that actually is quite shocking. In itself, because it's such an amazing vehicle for a business. And I just think it's really under-promoted.
So what is an employee ownership trust to start with?
So firstly, it's a government scheme that was put together by Nick Clegg when he was in coalition with David Cameron. And I only know that because I sat next to David at dinner about 5 years ago and I said, or, you know, 3 years ago, I said, I've just done this EOT thing. And he said it was a Nick Clegg idea, a liberal idea, which appealed. And I thought, after going to many VCs, after being approached by people trying to invest in the business, at first, I remember about 20 years ago, somebody said, you know, I'd like to put, can I buy 15% of your business? Yeah. It would pay for all your children's school fees or something. I was like, no, why would I? I don't want that. It's not going to do anything for me. And I went to VCs and they were like, yeah, well, we can, you know, we can sell your business for you. You might get X, you know, but they were, every person I knew, every female, especially founder who I knew, who had sold their business, nearly always wanted to buy it back.
Right.
They were horrified by what then happened to the business in terms of, you know, supply chain, changing the quality, making shortcuts, redundancies, you know, all the usual things that have to happen if you're going to amalgamate a business into another bigger umbrella.
Yes.
So the EOT was something that my managing director went to have a Christmas lunch with the bank manager and they said, oh, what's Victoria's succession plan? And Mark said, well, she's stumbling a little bit because, you know, we've been and see these people who, you know, are talking about investing in the business, but it just doesn't resonate with Victoria. It just doesn't chime. She's not very happy with it. And he said, well, has she considered an EOT? And Mark said, you know, what's that? So he brought me back this concept, which is basically you have your business valued by an outside auditor. You agree the valuation. Then you decide to put between 51% and 100% into the trust, which is owned by every single employee.
51% of the shares we're talking about.
Of the shares of the business.
Right.
So I, in the end, decided that 70% would go into the employee ownership trust because I wanted to keep 30% in the family because I think it's quite important to have a family on a board and have that passion that's come through the founder. And so that was sort of the way we went about it. And then logistically, how it happens is that the company, your company then has a debt to you. And that sits
so
on the books.
So this employee ownership trust effectively wrote you an IOU.
Exactly.
For your shares.
For my shares, for the 70%.
That then gets paid out over time from the company.
Through profit, basically through profit.
So you have to make a profit.
So you have to keep making a profit to make the payments possible.
Yes.
So it's quite critical that the business is steadfast.
It's a good business.
It's a good... You've got to take that punt as the founder because if your business goes under 3 years later, if you sail off into the sunset and go, oh, I'm going to get my check once a year and the business goes under, you'll get nothing.
Yes.
So, you know, it's in my interest to make sure the business continues to be successful and stable and steady.
And I can see you're still fully engaged. You've not sailed off anywhere.
No, I haven't sailed off anywhere.
So now you've got, you said 70% of your business, or what was your business, is now in this employee ownership trust. So everyone in the business shares in that.
Everyone in the business shares in that.
Has that changed how people are or how they think about the business?
The initial benefit, one of the initial benefits of an EOT is that any member of staff can earn up to £3,600 a year free of tax in a bonus.
Right.
We don't necessarily have to pay that bonus, but we do have a really nice bonus scheme at Brora based on quarterly budgets.
Right.
So it's not to do with profit because it's too complicated that. Mm. It's if we turn over what we're meant to turn over for March, April, May, then everyone gets a week's pay.
Right.
And again, it starts again then.
So each quarter you do that?
Each quarter.
Right.
So, you know, people are very engaged with that. Like our financial year starts on the 1st of March and we did our budget for March and now we're getting into the last 10 days of April and we're like watching. Are we going to get that? And then we got to get through May. So, you know, a week's extra salary is fantastic, especially when it's tax-free.
Yes. And this enables you to do that.
Yeah. And that enables us to do that. And then basically once the debt has been paid off to me over this period of time, then we will have the ability to share profits.
The dividends would go to the...
They'll go into the employees and to the other shareholders who own the other 30%.
Right.
So, you could start doing that now, but the primary thing when you do an EOT is to pay the founder off the debt. You know, you don't want that debt on your books. So my senior management's team, their goal is to pay me off as quickly as they can.
Right.
But I know realistically that will be a 10-year period.
That's going to take a while.
It'll take a while, but that's sort of fine.
Yeah.
I quite like that because I think it's quite difficult to go cold turkey on something that you've been running for
33
years.
You don't appear to want to do that. So why would, so selling something and this is a different way of doing it.
Oh, and one of the other bonuses for entrepreneurs listening to this is that those payments come to me tax-free.
Right.
So there is, so those payments, which sort of you could look like as a dividend, but there's no tax.
I think they might have changed that in the last budget.
Yes,
I think they reduced the advantage there. I can't remember the details, but it's no longer tax-free.
It's no longer completely
tax-free. But I think
tax-free.
It's discounted the tax, so there's still an advantage. It's a shame they did that because I think, as you say, it's a really interesting model.
Yeah, and it might stop people doing a bit because they have, it's not the same tax as you'd pay if you sold your business, but they have done some 50% tax on that bit that you, the extra bit or something.
Yeah.
But I was lucky. The timing was good. I realized that I needed to do it when I did it because also your valuation of your business is based on 4 years of accounts. And we had a really good run, sort of just really just before pre-COVID all the way through and then coming out of COVID was an amazing period for us.
Yes.
And but what's great is the last 3 years we've managed to retain this same level of profit.
So that's very good.
We're just looking to do the 10% on our turnover,
right,
which is, a well-run business. You want to make an average of 10%. If you do 15% 1 year, you're really feeling cock-a-hoop. And if you're down to 5%, it feels a bit tight.
Yeah.
10% generates you enough cash in the business for your stock, for your cash flow, for the ups and downs. It is my experience.
So that's in the retail sector.
Yeah.
It's different sector. No, I mean, our margins are much lower than that. In recruitment, with sort of low single figures typically.
Yeah. And in manufacturing, the same.
Yeah.
But in retail, that's what you sort of aim for. And that's a balancing all your rents. It's getting tougher and tougher because our turnover is not really going up at the moment, but obviously all our costs are going up a lot. And it would be nice to see, but, there's a lot going on in the world.
Yeah. I mean, there is huge cost pressure on business.
Yeah.
So from your point of view as a founder who's gone on this journey and now become, you're part of an employee ownership trust.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm thinking this gives you a legacy that would have been will be different to if you'd sold the business. Or I suppose passed it on to someone in your family. I mean, you've got a sort of combination there, haven't you? Team and the family.
I have to say, James, it feels really perfect. It feels really perfect from where I sit ideologically. It just feels like it's something I hope I have given an opportunity to some people who might not have had that opportunity. I hope if there are some people who stay with the business now for the next 10, 15 years, that they will really do pretty well out of it and give people an opportunity to, buy their own house, whatever it is.
Yeah, to really participate in its success.
Yeah.
So you'd recommend this model to other entrepreneurs?
I think because I was the 100% owner, it was quite a simple EOT because it was just passing,
You were the sole decision maker.
Yeah. And because I had lots of employees who'd already been with me a really long time, it felt a really nice way of being able to reward people. And I suppose it's made people even more loyal or more keen to come and work for the brand. But, we probably, outside of retail, because that's always a little bit more fluctuating in terms of employment, but at head office, I mean, maybe we employ one person a year, maybe one person leaves, you know.
So it's very stable. 50,
it's very stable. It's, yeah, you know, it's not a big turnaround. So, you know, when we're taking somebody new on board, we're really considering whether they're right, yeah, for the brand and the fit, because we want it to be long term.
So, I mean, have you been conflicted in terms of being paid out yourself with, at the same time, the need to invest in these new stores or the store upgrade?
Yeah.
I mean, are there tensions here? Because you obviously haven't received your full payment.
Yeah, interesting. I've had to really reduce my payments that were
planned.
Well,
I was wondering that. Yeah. Because you're reinvesting.
Yeah. If I hadn't done the shop fits, I would have done, you know, the debt would have been much lower. And I actually had to really agree that with the senior management team, because obviously their raison d'etre is to get rid of the debt as quickly as possible. So there was a sort of a little bit of a tension in the room between the four of us, because I was saying, on the one hand, I really don't mind not receiving what I'm meant to. I'm happy getting only 50% of it to be able to do these shop fits, because I see this as a short term, you know, if we can do this over a 3-year period. And also this year, we're replatforming our entire website and redoing our server room. So we need entirely new servers and an entirely new platform for the website. So we've got a really expensive year.
So there's a lot of, well, the business requires reinvestment,
yeah,
doesn't it? So
it
there is
does.
A tension there between paying out and investing. But it was interesting, they were keen to get it paid off so that they could start participating, I suppose.
Yeah, actually, gosh, that's interesting, James. Yeah, I hadn't thought of it in that way, which obviously I should have done.
Well, I don't know. I'm just thinking aloud, really. There are tensions here that I can see.
But I think basically the shops that have had the refit are doing really well.
So it's good.
And there is,
business.
We have got a comparison of shops that are looking pretty scruffy and old. And shops that really look beautiful, and they don't look blingy and snazzy, because that's not Bora's way. They just look like, they look a bit more like my home. They've got really beautiful dark wooden floorboards and beautiful blue painted walls and nice cabinetry and art on the walls. And so I've made it feel more like a home. And they used to be white, you know, whitewashed, clean whitewashed spaces. So it's quite a shift. And, yeah, I think...
So if anyone wants to visit one of these lovely shops, come on, where are they, Victoria? Tell us. You mentioned Marylebone and you mentioned Edinburgh. Where are the others?
Yeah, and there's a lovely one at Sloane Square, just off Sloane Square behind Peter Jones.
Yeah.
And then we've got really great locations. There's only 10. So, you know, they're quite key locations. There's one in Oxford, one in Harrogate, one in Bath.
Right.
Couple up in Edinburgh, because one's at the airport. We've even got one on Madison Avenue in New York.
Fantastic. So is that your only one outside of the UK?
Yeah, it is.
Is that doing well?
It's the only one I think I'm ever going to have outside of the UK. I don't know how people do it. It's so complicated having a store abroad.
Because
you can't visit it every week.
Yeah, you can't drop in.
You can't drop in. So you are really reliant. We have an incredible team there. And Michael, who runs it, again, has been with me for, you know, 10 years.
Right.
And the rest of the team pretty much have. So that's really steady. But, you know, just the duty, the customs, the change of tariffs, the, you know, the difficulty of getting things in and out. And then at the end of the season, we really have to bring the stock back.
Right.
Because we haven't got, after the sale, we've got no way of getting rid of the rest of the stock in America. So then we've got to pay the customs to bring it back.
Oh, that's very annoying.
So it's really
well, it's, double custom.
Yeah. So it is an
expensive
thing to do. It really is. Unless you're warehousing over in the US, you know, unless you're doing it on a big scale and you've got 10 shops and you've got your US website and you're warehousing there, then I think probably that's a bit more viable. But we haven't gone to that level. Mm. And actually, we've seen our web sales in America was the biggest growth, and it hasn't been in the last 2 years. We're doing really quite a lot in Europe and rest of world. You know.
So the market's moving.
Yeah.
So I'm sensing that your sort of ambition is not to expand around the world. What are you hoping to do next? In, you know, looking forwards for the business. What are your sort of priorities?
Yeah, we are. Funnily enough, having, you know, come through COVID, we sort of always said, "Oh, we'll never open another shop. We don't need another shop." But I am sort of beginning to look again at whether there might be probably more London-centric because you just get the footfall and you get the tourists and you get the sort of... It's a great combination when you get your locals, you get tourists, and you get visitors from out of London.
Right.
And if you can add a fourth, you get professional working people around that area.
Right.
So if you can sort of... So someone like Marylebone High Street gets four of those.
Yeah.
Sloane Square, probably less tourists, but it gets the country folk come in and the locals.
So where would your next location possibly be?
I don't know if I can say.
Why not?
Do you know what? An area that really flummoxes me. I've had two shops in Notting Hill, plus I've had a pop-up shop in Notting Hill. And I've never really managed to make... My first one in Ledbury Road that I had before the internet really, really worked. Then there was a flip moment when, do you remember, for a tiny bit of time, they brought congestion charge into Notting Hill.
Yes.
And things all changed and everyone went to Westfield
right.
in Shepherd's Bush.
It killed it, did it?
And it really killed it. Yeah. And Ledbury Road, the rent went up and up and up to a crazy level. So we got out
Half of it's empty now. If you went down there now, you'd see lots of boarded up shops.
Exactly. Yeah. Because they've just been too greedy.
Yeah.
And funnily enough, they always call Westbourne Grove the sort of the graveyard of retail.
Right.
It sort of looks really nice and it could be like a Marylebone High Street, but it just isn't.
Yeah.
And you don't get that mix that nobody's working around there. Half the people who live around there, it's a second home and they don't live there anyway. Mm. You don't get so many tourists. They all go down Portobello. And I love Portobello Road and I would have a shop in a minute on Portobello Road, but it's also quite scuzzy and quite markety and quite Woodborough look sort of quite out of place on Portobello Road. So I'm quite muddled about Notting Hill because I sort of still feel we could do well there. I've got lots of my really old loyal customers live in Notting Hill, so they probably go to Marylebone High Street.
Mm.
You know, they're more likely to go there.
I mean, there are a lot of businesses that began in the Portobello market. I mean, it's a real sort of entrepreneurial hotspot. Yeah, which is interesting.
Yeah.
So you're still making your mind up about that.
I'm still making my mind up. I'm sniffing around.
Your next store.
I'm sniffing around. So maybe, but you know, James, it's a huge investment opening a store.
Sure.
As you know, it's a huge investment. All that shop fit, all the staff training, the stock that has to be in the store. It's not really movable stock.
No, but it's good to hear that you're still so positive about retail.
Yeah. Yeah.
What percentage of your sales would be online versus retail?
Well, the big thing has been the flip in the last 7 years. We were probably 2/3 retail, 1/3 web, and we're now 2/3 web, 1/3 retail.
Right.
And the business is more profitable because of it.
Yeah.
Less costs, much
less costs. But is there a need to have retail for sort of brand awareness and people coming to see things, feel things?
All
of that. So it is a hybrid model, isn't it, really? You couldn't just go web. Or could you?
Businesses starting today can certainly just go web and then they have pop-ups and things like that. And there's some really, you know, successful mail order businesses, web businesses that don't do retail, but not my model because we started as retailers. So there are still people who go to the original King's Road shop, which is right at the bottom of the King's Road. And actually that is now an outlet store.
Right.
So it's a really fun store to go and visit because it's not just an outlet in terms of its end of season clothes. It's also where all our samples go. So when you make a piece of clothing, first time round, nearly always the sleeve's a bit too long or the hem's a bit, you know, it's just something you want to tweak, but there's nothing essentially that wrong with it. So that will be a real bargain. So the King's Road's full of, you know, and where else would these pieces go? You know, if they didn't go to the outlet.
Yeah.
And sometimes at the mill, because our colours are made especially for us, our cashmere colours, if we've got like 20 kilos of saffron yellow left at the end of the season, then we do what's called a knit-up order.
Right.
So we knit up. When the mill's less busy, we put some things on the machine and then they go to the clearance shop.
Right.
So you might pick up something that's, you know, 50%.
So that's still an important part of the mix.
Yeah.
Well, I'm so pleased to hear that because I really worry about town centres sort of being hollowed out and retail disappearing. And I mean, so with this sort of cost pile on that we've been experiencing, it becomes more difficult to run a retail operation.
Yeah, so it really does. But I mean, we have got some disaster stories. I can tell you one really, really bad one.
Come on. I hope to finish on a high note, but let's do this first.
We had a really bad one.
What was that?
Because Edinburgh was so good, we thought, Glasgow, why not? Right. I mean, fabulous city. I know it well. Two of my girls went to the art school there. We opened and we did no business at all.
No business at all.
We did no business. Sometimes we did £52.
Right.
I mean, you know, it was shocking. And we stayed open for a year.
Right.
And then we thought it's cheaper to close it.
So what did you get wrong? Why did...
Location, Glasgow, they spend money on clothes, but they love a label. They want Prada, Gucci, they want the label, they want the bling, they want to show the label, they want the label on the outside. Right. They want the logo.
Right.
So they'll definitely spend money on clothes, but they want them to be lavish. They don't want subtlety.
Right.
Whereas in Edinburgh, it's much more old school and
yeah.
They like the quality and they like, you know.
So I don't know if this is going to be controversial, but you're more Edinburgh than Glasgow than your brand.
Don't really like to think that because Glasgow is so groovy. No, I would like to be. I don't know. We couldn't make it work. It was either the wrong location or the wrong city.
But you tried, and that's the important thing.
We tried.
That's the important thing. I think you give me every sense you're going to keep trying and keep doing more, which is...
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think you've got to keep taking risks.
Yeah. Well, that's the point I think we should conclude on. You've got to keep taking risks, Victoria. I like that as a statement. Now, I always ask at the end, thank you for sharing your thoughts and experiences, but I also ask at the end two questions. And because at Reed, we love Mondays. The first of these two questions is, what gets you up on a Monday morning?
A swim.
A swim? Mm. Where do you
swim? I'm a really big swimmer. I really love swimming. I'm very bad in the morning. Really shockingly bad. Right. I would sleep like a teenager till 10 o'clock if my alarm didn't go off, which is really weird for a woman in her late 50s.
Right.
But my alarm goes off and I put my swimsuit on and I go for a swim.
Do you go in a pool or in?
In a pool.
Not in
you
wild
know,
swimming.
I know. I'm not brave enough.
No.
And that really gets me up.
That's interesting. And my last question from my interview book, Why You, 101 Interview Questions You'll Never Fear Again, is where do you see yourself in 5 years' time?
Oh, I really love where I am right now. So the only thing that I know is coming my way is grandchildren.
Oh, that's
so
exciting.
I will definitely...
So you know they're coming your way.
Yeah.
Oh, congratulations.
Yeah.
I hope you enjoy being a grandmother.
Yeah, I'm really excited.
Yeah, I bet you are. Well, that's wonderful. So thanks so much, Victoria, for coming to talk to me today.
Well, it's been a pleasure.
I'm enjoying wearing your Brora jumper, and I hope to continue wearing this one and others for many years to come.
Thanks very much, James. Thank you.
Thank you, Victoria, for joining me on All About Business. I'm your host, James Reed, Chairman and CEO of Reed, a family-run recruitment and philanthropy company. If you'd like to find out more about Brora or Reed, you'll find all the links in the show notes. Thank you for listening, and see you next time.